Illinois. The festival will feature a production of the comic opera Cinderella by Rossini, a Saturday evening symphony, and daytime activities. More information is available at www.sugarcreekfestival.org.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we will be talking about politics in Russia with two reporters for The Washington Post, Peter Baker and Susan Glasser. They were the Moscow bureau chiefs for The Washington Post from January 2001 to November 2004 and have co-authored a book that presents some of their experiences, what they saw when they were there, and concentrates on the career of Vladimir Putin, the president. The title of their book is Kremlin Rising, Vladimir Putin's Russia and the End of Revolution. It's published by Scribner, and the book is just recently out. The book takes a look at his career, Mr. Putin's, and his effort, as the authors argue, to transform Russia back into an authoritarian state. The two say that this is an ideal case study of some of the hazards of democracy building when the United States loses interest and turns the other way. The book is just recently out, and you can find it in the bookstore. As we talk this morning, questions are certainly welcome. And all you have to do to be a part of the conversation, if you're listening, is to pick up the telephone and call. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But listeners are welcome to call with questions. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the local number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, and it would be a long-distance call, or if you were listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, one or the way or the other, you can use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, Mr. Baker, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And Ms. Glasser.
Yes, hi, thank you.
Well, thank you to both of you, and certainly we appreciate you giving us some of your time. How unusual is it for a married couple to be co-bureau chiefs somewhere? I can only think of one other case, and I guess that's Nick Kristof and his wife who covered China for the New York Times. Does this happen very often?
Well, that's a great case and a terrific example for all sorts of couples out there. It's happening more and more just because being a foreign correspondent is such a difficult life, such a difficult assignment that, frankly, it helps to have your spouse doing the very same thing. So the Post right now has several couples out there.
Hmm. Did you choose this assignment, or what did the Post say to you? Guess where you're going next?
Well, they didn't actually dragoon us into going off to Siberia. We were very interested in it when they floated the idea to us a few years ago. So it turned out to work for both sides.
And you, before this, you had been political reporters covering, was it the White House, or was it more generally covering Washington?
Well, I covered the White House, and Susan was, in fact, my editor for a while and also wrote about money and politics for the national section. So we have a good deal of Washington background.
Hmm. So how, when you were going now, this would be, so you would have been experienced political reporters, but this would be really different going in a situation where you were covering the politics of another country. How difficult was it for you to settle into this new job and start to learn about how things work in Russia?
Well, it was a difference. Obviously, they don't have quite the same ethos of that Washington does. On the other hand, the nice thing is when you spoke to people there, for the most part, they weren't arguing with you about background this and off the record that. They pretty much just said what they wanted to say. So it was a different environment. The other thing, of course, is we had to travel a lot when you cover a country with 11 time zones and actually also the other 14 former Soviet republics. It meant you're on the road a great deal of the time, which is very different than Washington, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like overall the point that you're making here is that here this particular period where you were fortunate enough to be there and see what was going on is yet another critical kind of period in post-Soviet Russia, and that contrary to what people might think about the possibility that the country was moving in the direction of positive change, it sounds as if you're arguing that, in fact, in many ways, rather than moving forward, it was moving backward.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that it might not have seemed as dramatic as the early 1990s. There haven't been tanks in the street. There haven't been talks of coups and economic collapses and that sort of thing. But what we came to see was that over the last 5 years in Russia really has been a critical time for the country, every bit as much as Boris Yeltsin's takeover was in the early 1990s. And then what Vladimir Putin has done in office is really end the democratic experiment that began with perestroika 15 years ago.
You talk about a number of things in the book. It covers a lot of territory about Putin and how he has reacted to and moved against anyone who would be terribly critical. He's moved against the media. He's moved against some of the most wealthy and powerful individuals, all of the people we come to know as the oligarchs in the country, and has also moved to consolidate power in the Kremlin by weakening state governments and so forth. So we can talk about a lot of these things, and certainly he's had a lot of difficult things to deal with during the time he's been president. But you begin your story with the story of the Beslan massacre, when the Chechen terrorists took over this school. A lot of people were then killed when Russian commandos then stormed the place. And I think a lot of people in Russia and elsewhere were very critical of the way that Mr. Putin and the Moscow government handled this. Do you think that this, by looking at this story, that this is really indicative of a lot of things that are going on now in Russia?
Well, Beslan really captured a lot of things going on. Right, exactly. Because it was Russia right now is beset by terrorism. It's still mired in a very long and bloody and seemingly intractable war in Chechnya, which Putin has, in fact, promoted. And the consequences of Beslan spoke to the issues of democracy and rule of law. When the battle began in the school and the gunfire was going off and the bombs were going off, Russian television, state television, got no instructions from the Kremlin, so they showed Brazilian soap operas. You know, there was no genuine accountability afterwards for the lies that the government told during the siege. There are no, you know, 9/11 commission equivalents there, genuinely. And in fact, President Putin used the occasion to announce his plan to attack terrorism, and his plan consisted of eliminating the election of governors across the 89 regions of Russia. Imagine if the President of the United States had reacted to 9/11 by saying, okay, our answer to this is to cancel the election of the governors of California and Texas and Oklahoma and Nebraska and Illinois. So it captured a lot of what was happening in Russia all in one terribly tragic event.
Hmm. What kind of argument did he make, or did he even have to make an argument justifying doing that and explaining what exactly that had to do with terrorism?
Well, the thing that's so striking about Russia today is the absence of competition in the political space. And what that means is that even people who had every reason to object, i.e. the 89 governors themselves, were, for the most part, afraid to say anything opposed to the proposal publicly. So there was, in effect, no debate whatsoever about it, which meant that Vladimir Putin had to give very little in the way of reasons for why he was canceling gubernatorial elections. Basically, he said the unity of the state is threatened, meaning by the separatist movement in Chechnya and by the terrorist acts in southern Russia, and therefore I am taking this move. He never was forced in a political process to explain what exactly he meant by that.
Hmm. Putin was was first elected, or he first ran in 2000. He was reelected in 2004. He received 70% of the vote. And that would seem to be a significant endorsement for Mr. Putin, although then one might raise the question was, what alternative do people have if they decided they wanted to vote for somebody else? How do you, to the extent that you can answer a question like this, how does your average Russian feel about Vladimir Putin and what he's done during the time that he's been president?
Go ahead.
That's a very good question. In many ways, gets at the heart of the question about where Russia's headed, because Putin is genuinely popular. There's no question about it. Perhaps that 70% total is inflated somewhat by the absence of meaningful political competition, by the heavy-handed use of state television, really, to propagandize on Putin's behalf. But at the same time, people see in Vladimir Putin really an antidote to the Yeltsin era of dislocation and chaos and upheaval, and they find him to be a very appealing figure. Even his background in the KGB, as surprising as that might seem to an American audience, gets him some votes and a fair amount of support, because the KGB was perceived to be one of the least corrupted institutions in Soviet society, and drawing on sort of an elite back in Soviet times. So it has a very different image and reputation than you might think.
You know, just not too long ago here, I had the opportunity to talk with a woman who was a Russian journalist who was here visiting the campus. There was a conference going on, and she was here, and she was on the program, and we talked about a number of things about Russia, about what it's like to be a journalist in Russia these days. And I asked her the question. I said, well, if we could go out and round up a representative group of Russians, young, old, rich, poor, city people, country people, and ask them, how do you think that you're doing, and particularly, is Russia better off? Do you think you are better off now than during Soviet times? And the answer that she gave me, I think, was very subtle and yet sort of unsatisfying, because she said, well, it depends. It depends on who they are. What they're going to say. Given that that I'm sure that that's true, I wonder what your take on that same question is. If we went out and asked people, are you better off now than you were, what kind of answers you get, and particularly who would say that they're doing better and who would say that they're not?
Well, it's a terrific question, and it's very hard to define. I mean, again, remember, it's a country of such vast proportions that you get different answers in different places. If you live in Moscow, your answer to the question, are you doing better, is almost invariably going to be yes. And that's probably true in St. Petersburg and some at least of the second-tier cities. The economy has gotten better. It's stabilized. They don't have the ruble collapse that they did in the 90s. They don't worry about life savings. They don't have the wage arrears that were common back then. But having said that, there's still a very deep and intractable poverty in Russia. A quarter of the country lives below the Russian poverty line, and that's defined, I think, as something like $70 a month. So, it's still obviously a very patchy situation, and many very people still romanticize the days of the Soviet Union. Even if they are better off economically, many of them will tell you they're not, because they sort of miss what they perceived as the stability and predictability and attractiveness of their life before, hard as it is for us to understand.
Our guests in this hour of Focus 580, Peter Baker and Susan Glasser, they work for the Washington Post, and they were, from January 2001 until November 2004, the Moscow bureau chiefs for the paper. They're now back in living and working in Washington, D.C., continuing to work for the paper. Together, they've written a book about some of what they saw and the reporting that they did in Russia. The book is titled Kremlin Rising, Vladimir Putin's Russia and the End of Revolution. It's published by Scribner. It's relatively new here, just out at the beginning of June. Should be in the bookstore if you want to read the book. And questions here on the program are welcome if you'd like to talk with them. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. When Vladimir Putin just first came on the scene, or at least as far as people in the West and the Western media were concerned, he first came on the scene, when he came along to succeed Boris Yeltsin, a lot of people were saying, who is, they say, Vladimir Putin. We never heard of Vladimir Putin. Who is this guy? Tell us something about his background and how one would answer that question. Well, who is Vladimir Putin?
Well, I think, really this was an extraordinary political project. Actually, some of the people involved in it in the Kremlin called it Project Putin. They took an obscure, basically completely unknown former mid-level KGB agent, and they turned him into the leader of the Kremlin. The guy was at literally 2% in the polls when he was plucked from obscurity to become the prime minister of Russia and Yeltsin's heir apparent. He had grown up in St. Petersburg at the time, called Leningrad. He was an admirer of the old-time spy propaganda movies and films that glorified the KGB and the fight against Nazi Germany. And he had as his ambition to join the KGB even from when he was a teenager, actually tried to walk in and sign up. I think what was unclear was why Putin was chosen for this. And we did a lot of reporting with some of his colleagues, with people who are familiar with Yeltsin's inner circle. And a very interesting theme emerged, which was that they thought he would be loyal to Yeltsin and to the people who created him. They thought that he would make sure that they were not subject to prosecution when he came into office and they left. And that's why they picked him, was loyalty. What they didn't expect was that he would emerge as such an independent figure in his own right.
So it is indeed the case that he is an independent figure, and it's not that there's some sort of shadowy cabal that's pulling the strings behind the scenes, that he is in fact the man who is in power?
Well, there are shadowy cabals everywhere in Russia. The question is, he's actually, you know, is he part of one? Does he lead one in that sense? And that it definitely seems to have been the case that in the last 2 years, particularly since 2003, that his former colleagues in the KGB and the FSB, the successor agency, have come to the fore. Are they controlling him, or is he controlling them? I suspect more of the latter than the former.
It seemed that when he was running and early on in his career, he really, at least as far as the West was concerned, really tried to downplay the KGB connection. He was trying to say, "Whoa, I was just kind of a minor functionary out there in the boonies, and I was working at a desk, and I never assassinated anybody, and I wasn't involved in anything, any covert operations. So it's okay. You don't have to worry about me." How much is known about what he actually did do?
Well, it's an interesting question. There are still a lot of blank spots on the record as far as Vladimir Putin's KGB record goes. He was posted abroad to the consulate in Dresden, East Germany, which is a real backwater posting. Basically, he wasn't even in sort of the capital of Cold War spying, Berlin. He was put in Dresden, which was a second-tier post, and he was, you know, enlisted to, you know, spy on the locals there. One of his last acts as the wall was falling and Germany was being reunited, Putin was supposed to put a spy ring back into place that would continue spying for the KGB even after the two Germanys were reunited. And that spy ring fell apart within a few months of Putin's departure and return to the West. And they sort of turned tails and acknowledged how they'd been recruited by Putin. So he doesn't have a very good record as far as what's known publicly. He was only achieve the rank of lieutenant colonel in the KGB. And, you know, this is a place where title inflation is rampant, where, you know, everybody made it general. And, in fact, Putin came back to Russia and realized his career in the agency was basically over, which is how he decided to come out of the shadows.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about Project Putin and then what it was that all of the people who were involved in this were really going for, particularly in terms of what kind of post-Soviet Russia they really wanted. And was this in fact motivated in part or in large part by this feeling that what was once a superpower had been weakened, and that what they were interested in was trying to build up the country again to something of its former power and glory?
Yeah, no, of course, and Putin appeals to that. That's absolutely his appeal, you know, a great Russia again. Now, that's not the Soviet Union, exactly. Putin is smart enough to understand that in the modern world, he's not going to rebuild a military power that would compete with the United States. And frankly, given the experience in Chechnya, he can't even have right now a military power that competes with a few thousand terrorists in his southern border. So economics is the way he wants to rebuild Russia, and that's been his sort of focus. At the same time, he uses that to then influence his neighbors, Ukraine, Belarus, the Caucasus in Central Asia, and to flex his muscles, if you will. So this appeals to that desire among the Russian to be important. The sense of the loss of identity of the 90s is absolutely profound, and they're still searching for that idea of what the Russian idea is today.
I'm sure that that one of the reasons that that what happened in Beslan was so damaging for Putin was that when he was running for office the first time, he made a very strong pitch to Russians, saying that I'm gonna clean up this Chechen thing, and that he really projected this image of a tough guy. And much in contrast, I'm sure, to Boris Yeltsin, that he was this hard as he was young, he was hard as nails, he was the former KGB guy, that if anybody was going to be able to crack down on Chechen terrorists, it was going to be him. And it doesn't really seem that that has happened. And certainly there have been a number of cases where it made him and the Russian government look really bad. And that was one of them. In how powerful is Chechnya and what's going on there in people's minds in Russia, and to what extent does that contribute to their feeling that somehow Putin has not been as strong or as effective a leader as they perhaps had hoped when he was standing for election the first time?
Well, no question, the war in Chechnya is largely what helped bring Vladimir Putin to power. It cemented his new popularity. It created in him the image of the tough guy, as you mentioned. And it was extremely popular when he first came to office, this idea that he was going to go in and clean up this mess that had been left festering by Boris Yeltsin. Of course, he also said this was a war he was going to go in and win in 2 weeks, and continue to repeat that promise over the next several years. And now it's really settled into a grinding, long-term and seemingly never-ending war. But the thing about Putin is that he's never stopped talking tough on Chechnya. And even as the public support for the conflict has long since disappeared, two-thirds of the public supports negotiations with the rebels in Chechnya. Putin has said he would never consider such a thing. So there's a real impasse on the political side of things. But in fact, after Beslan, the lesson that Putin drew from that tragedy was that he's been, if anything, not tough enough. He said what he took away from that terrible terrorist act in which several hundred school children and their teachers and parents were killed in southern Russia was that the weak get beaten, and we were weak. And, you know, Putin has made it very clear that he has no interest whatsoever in a political solution to the Chechen conflict.
Mm. Well, certainly that's a problem for them. That is, in the Kremlin, they see that as a problem, because here at various places around Russia, they have these little pockets of people who are interested in greater autonomy and in some cases in actual independence. And of course, the Chechens have felt like they were an independent nation for a long time and don't really want to have anything to do with Russia. The Russians are intent on, after the Soviet Union comes apart, they're intent in seeing that the same thing doesn't happen with Russia. So I'm sure in the Kremlin, they think that the Chechnya is an object lesson. And what we're going to do is we're going to be tough in Chechnya as a way of saying to anybody anywhere else in Russia, if you would even think about breaking away from Russia, this is what's going to happen to you, so you just better not even consider the idea. So
yeah,
that makes it critical for them to seem to be strong on this, so they can deliver a message to anybody else that says, if you think about this, this is what's going to happen.
Well, I mean, if that was the message, it was certainly received. It was even received in Chechnya. Most Chechens that I interviewed, ordinary folks, not fighters, are just fed up with the whole thing. They don't care. Independence or part of Russia, what they've had over the last 10 years in particular has been unremitting bloodshed. Hundreds of thousands of people dead, wounded, homeless, and they just don't care about the politics of it anymore. It's been such a devastating decade for their society. The city of Grozny, the capital of Chechnya, absolutely obliterated in effect. I mean, every building in the city, if you drive around, is a shell, crumbled and hollowed out the way you see the old footage from World War II, in the worst of Dresden, for instance. They dropped more tonnage of bombs on Grozny than any city in Europe has seen since World War II. So, the idea of political aspirations at this point don't really appeal very much to even Chechens, much less to many other ethnic groups around the Russian Federation.
Mm-hmm. Our guests in this part of Focus 580 are Peter Baker and Susan Glasser. They're former Moscow bureau chiefs for the Washington Post. They were there from the winter of 2001 through the fall of 2004 and still work for the paper and now are in Washington, D.C., have written a book that's titled Kremlin Rising, Vladimir Putin's Russia and the End of Revolution. It's been out now since early June, so if you want to read the book, look for it in the bookstore. Questions, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Another sort of piece of Putin and the people surrounding him consolidating power has to do with their control over the media. And that's another one of these stories that you tell and takes us back to an earlier kind of crisis that Putin had to face and was there was similar sort of criticism. It's perhaps not as bad as Beslan, but certainly it made the government look really bad. And this, I'm sure perhaps people will remember the Kursk, the submarine that sunk and the crew was lost. This and the way that this ties in with the media is that his conflict, Mr. Putin's conflict with the head of NTV, Vladimir Kaczynski, really apparently goes back to the way that NTV reported on the whole business of the Kursk. Can you talk about that?
Right. Absolutely. That's right. He was absolutely fed up with that. He called up the station at one point when they had widows of or women who were, in fact, didn't know they were yet widows, but whose husbands were down in the deep, dark sea, worried about their fate. When they were shown on Russian television, he called up the television angrily and said, "You put these whores on television just to humiliate me. You bought them for $100. He didn't even believe that these were real people. Everything to him was a political provocation and no sympathy for the actual people. When he met with relatives behind closed doors, they assailed him for the government's slow reaction. "Why didn't you accept help from foreign governments?" they said. He said, "I did as soon as it was offered." They said, "We know that's not true because television told us that wasn't true." And he said, "Television, they're just lying, lying, lying." And that really sealed the fate. They was never going to let that happen again, and that's why when you saw Beslan happen, you were watching Brazilian soap operas on Russian television, and if you wanted news in Russia, you had to go to CNN or BBC.
What now? Is it? Are there people there who are in a position that journalists, that is, who are in a position to be critical of the government, or has this become so hazardous that most journalists just don't want to do it anymore?
Well, there's no question that the self-censorship has kicked in Russia in a big way, that people are very attuned there, not surprisingly, after 7 decades of communist dictatorship, people are very attuned at understanding and taking their cues from even subtle signals from the authorities. But it's also become much more overt. Every Friday in the Kremlin, according to our sources, they would have a meeting with Putin's top political advisors and the directors of the major television stations, and they would come in and they would be given a written list of expected news topics for the next week, along with the Kremlin's recommendations for what they should and should not cover. It got to the point where in recent years there would be a topic, Chechnya, as in the entire war in Chechnya, recommendation, do not cover. And I think that tells you a lot about the very overt process of controlling what people saw and heard on sensitive topics.
Hmm. That's sort of on the top end, with the most widespread in public media. There must indeed be journalists, though, that are still take their mission as journalists strongly enough so that they're willing to criticize.
Absolutely. You just can't do it on national television anymore in Russia. But in fact, there's a whole host of internet news sites, of print newspapers, in particular in Moscow, where people are doing, aggressive reporting, investigative reporting, political reporting. There's a very brave radio station that first grew out of the 1991 August coup in Moscow called Echo of Moscow, which continues to be a vital source of political news and information and commentary in Russia. So, it's not that you can't get information now. This is not the Soviet Union. These tactics being used by Putin are modernized versions and modernized takes on the past, rather than simply trying to restore an old and very unsuited to the present day communist era dictatorship. That's not what's going on.
Also, something that has happened during this period has to do with the Russian economy. And one of the things that happened after the fall of the Soviet Union and this move towards market capitalism was that industries that previously had been nationalized were actually up for grabs. And what happened was a handful of people that had the right kind of connections managed to snatch up some of the country's largest, most important, most valuable industries at fire sale prices, and a number of people became very, very rich. And that these are people that also became very powerful and apparently were decided that they should have some influence over government. And here was these are people that also have come into conflict with Putin. He has taken them on. And maybe the big case study is Mikhail Khodorkovsky. The man who was one time was said to be Russia's richest man. He was the head of Yukos, a big oil company. He was arrested. He was put on trial. Let's talk about Khodorkovsky and Yukos.
Sure. Oh, it's a fantastic and interesting case. Not fantastic for him, but very intriguing for Russian watchers because it was an interesting tabula rasa. Where was Putin taking the country? Is he going to rein in corruption and these crooked oligarchs who took over state assets? Or was he, in fact, going after a political rival, somebody who was challenging the monopoly on power that Putin was creating in the Kremlin? The fact of the matter is that Mikhail Khodorkovsky, like many of the other oligarchs, became very rich through some very questionable auctions in the 1990s. But the question is, did he do anything different than all the other ones? He's the one who's behind jail right now. He's the one who's convicted. The others are all perfectly free because they didn't challenge the Kremlin. As one analyst put it, an analyst who, by the way, hates Khodorkovsky and is very sympathetic to Putin, charging an oligarch with tax evasion is like issuing speeding tickets at the Indy 500. It's certainly, you could do that to any Russian, probably, certainly the oligarchs. So it's a matter of choice, who you choose to go after, and that's where the politics comes into it.
And certainly others of this group of individuals have felt threatened. Probably one of the most famous one is Boris Berezovsky,
sure.
who felt apparently so threatened that he decided to leave Russia, and he's now living in London, I believe.
Right. And Khodorkovsky was told to leave the country, too. He just refused to do it. He says, Russia's my home. I want my children to grow up here. I refuse to do it. I'm fighting for the future of my country. Now, whether you credit him with noble aims or not, he definitely had every opportunity to leave the country. That's what they wanted him to do, and he chose to stand and fight.
Mm-hmm. So he obviously thought maybe he was big enough so that he could take on Putin?
Well, yeah. I think that's right, exactly. I think there was some misapprehension, I think, perhaps on his part, about how this would end up.
Did you? I heard Susan drawing a breath there to jump in.
I think I cut her off.
No, not at all. Not at all. I was going to say that it's an amazing saga because I think Khodorkovsky had the sense of himself as an independent political agent in a society that was not yet ready for that kind of businessman politician. And Putin made it very clear that I don't care how many billions of dollars you have. And at one point, Khodorkovsky, just a couple years ago, was the richest man in the world under the age of 40. He had $15 billion at his height. Now he's serving a 9-year jail term. So I think that the message was very clear about the relative virtues of money versus political power in today's Russia.
And the other thing to remember here, too, with this one is it's not just that he's behind bars. It's they basically dismantled the company. Yukos was the biggest oil producer in Russia and the most successful private company created since the end of the Soviet Union. It was building a reputation among Western investors and analysts. In fact, Khodorkovsky, whatever his crimes or failures or what have you of the past, was making a very big show of cleaning up transparent books and doing things the right way by Western business standards and accounting standards. So then they took apart the company and, in effect, put it into the hands of the state. So that's the bottom line there.
Hmm. Is there a possibility that that there will be similar kinds of prosecutions of other people like him?
Well, that's been the big concern, certainly, and business in particular, Western businesses have been very jittery about investing in Russia as a result of the controversy surrounding Khodorkovsky and Yukos. You know, the Kremlin has repeatedly sought to insist that this was some sort of isolated case, but it's not entirely clear where that's headed. I think the message certainly is when it comes to natural resources, and in particular oil, like Yukos, that the government wants to have a much bigger role in dividing up those resources than it did in the 1990s.
How much is there a deliberate sort of effort in the Kremlin to gain, once again, gain control of these things that formerly had been state enterprises?
Well, particularly the energy sector, I think, that the Kremlin is worried about, because that's the strategic heart of the country, in effect. Russia is the largest oil producer in the world alongside Saudi Arabia, but every other large oil producer in the world, by and large, most of them, the state controls the industry. Putin and his guys believe that this was a mistake of the 90s to give that up, and piece by piece they seem to be interested in consolidating at least some more control over it. And when the ones that they're not taking over directly, they're simply intimidating into following their direction. Another large oil company, Lukoil, which in fact is now the largest because of Yukos's, you know, dismemberment, one day came forward and started sending hundreds of millions of dollars in additional taxes to the state that the state hadn't even asked for, saying, well, we just wanted to go ahead and do this.
After the collapse of the Soviet Union, I know people in Washington, D.C., the big question that they were all wrestling with was, what now does Russia mean to the United States? And certainly there, people, I think, felt that it wasn't the kind of military threat that it was before, but that it was important for the United States to have positive relations with Russia. That became perhaps more critical after September 11th, and the United States was looking to build relationships and to how many allies they could count in the war on terror. And it was interesting here that there was also a sort of a reciprocal relationship going because of Chechnya. And the Russians, the Americans were saying to each other, well, you know, we each of us have our wars on terror, and we'll support each other, and also we'll get out of each other's way, which put the United States in the position that if they wanted the Russians to back us, then we pretty much had to back them, which meant at the very least not criticizing Russia and what they did in Chechnya or any place else. Let's talk about the relationship between President Bush and Mr. Putin. President Bush famously said, well, I looked in this man's eyes and looked into his soul, and this is a guy we could do business with, or whatever it was that he said. How exactly would you characterize the relationship, not only between the two countries, but between the two men?
Well, this is probably a remark that President Bush these days wishes that he hadn't made, in the sense that it sort of boxed him in. And certainly members of his administration have become considerably more concerned about the direction in which Putin is taking the country, since the two of them had that famous meeting back in 2001 and looked into each other's eyes and took the measure of their soul. At the same time, I think you're right in pointing out that Bush and Putin have generally gotten along very much in the post-September 11th environment, and their mutually reinforcing wars on terror have, in a way, given them common cause compared to even the rest of Europe, I think. The Bush administration doesn't want Russia to be a problem. It has too much already going on its agenda to put Russia back into the center of attention. And so in that sense, I think they're looking for what concessions Putin is willing to give them, whether it's allowing U.S. military presence in Central Asia for the first time, U.S. military bases on former Soviet soil in the wake of September 11th, a presence that continues to this day, whether it's help in the war in Afghanistan, or at least a tacit agreement not to cause too much trouble in the continuing problems with Iraq. I think those things are important to the Bush administration when it comes to its dealings with Russia, because it has enough going on its agenda already.
Well, do you think that the United States would have done anything differently if it had not been concerned with maintaining Russian support for the United States war on terror after September 11th?
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, it was interesting to go back and look at the record. In 1999, President Bush made a very, very tough critique of Russia while he was running for president, which he said, you cannot look the other way at the brutality and what's going on in Chechnya, and we have to be honest about that. And we haven't heard about that since. Condi Rice, in an article in Foreign Affairs magazine, which was meant as sort of a manifesto of the future Bush foreign policy, said they were no longer going to be interested in Russia's internal affairs so much, like the democracy and the economics and so forth. And they were going to deal with Russia as a great power in terms of strategic issues like ABM treaty, missile defense, NATO, these sorts of questions. So that's all been turned on its head. 9/11 sort of reshuffled everything in the way they see things. And the other thing they said was, we don't want any happy talk, a personalized relationship the way Clinton had with Yeltsin. And, of course, what we have now is a very personalized relationship between President Bush and President Putin.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting, I think, to go back and think about the administration and how it thought about foreign policy before September 11th. And I think that some people would say that it was telling that they chose Condoleezza Rice to be the security advisor because she was a Soviet specialist. Mm-hmm. That was her thing. And mm-hmm. and I suppose some people would say even at that point, they would have said, look, the Cold War is over. Yes, Russia is important, but do you really think that it's important for your top foreign policy person or your security advisor to be a Sovietologist, which she was, and I suppose in some ways still is.
Well, I think that the most important factor for her with Bush wasn't necessarily her particular specialty, but the relationship she built with him. She had come off her father's NSC staff and knew the younger Bush, and they forged a relationship of trust and friendship there. I mean, they shared a passion for sports, and she spent a lot of time with both the president and the first lady when they weren't president and first lady. So I think it was a matter of trust, and she provided a schooling for him, if you will, in foreign policy broadly, not just about Russia, that he didn't have coming into the job.
Well, has she been particularly important in crafting the kind of policy the United States has had towards Russia?
Absolutely. She's been very personally involved in that, and in fact has forged a personal relationship with Sergei Ivanov, who's perhaps the most influential member of Putin's cabinet. He's also, like Putin, a former KGB spy. He served undercover as a spy in Great Britain during the Cold War. He's now the defense minister and, you know, is widely considered to be sort of the leader of the Siloviki faction inside the Kremlin. In other words, the faction drawn from the former veterans of the KGB. And Condoleezza Rice has preferred to deal directly with him throughout the last few years in sort of forging this new relationship between the U.S. and Russia. So I think you can look to her and say she's the one who has set the policy.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guests, Susan Glasser and Peter Baker, they work for The Washington Post. They were the Moscow bureau chiefs for the paper from January 2001 to November 2004, and they are the co-authors of a book that's titled Kremlin Rising, Vladimir Putin's Russia and the End of Revolution. Came out in early June, published by Scribner, and questions are welcome. If people who are listening want to call in, 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana listeners. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Now, what sort of political opposition is there, opposition to Putin and his circle? And do they have much potential for pushing policy one way or another?
Well, there is opposition to him, but there's not very effective opposition. He succeeded in marginalizing all of the figures who stand for something different in his society, or he's actually created opposition parties to suit his own interest. It's a very unique feature of Russia today that the opposition party in the last parliamentary elections that got the most attention coming out of nowhere was actually a creation of the Kremlin. The ones who were left, who were in genuine opposition, are seen as responsible for the chaos, if you will, of the 1990s, and therefore the public doesn't genuinely support them. Susan will often cite, for instance, polls that show that in Russia today, perhaps only 30% of Russians even consider themselves to be Democrats, small d. And even then, the two, quote, Democratic parties, unquote, in the last election could only manage 7% of the vote.
We have a caller here to talk to. Let's do that. Someone listening this morning in Chicago on our toll-free line, line 4. Right,
yeah,
here.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I missed about 5 minutes of your talk just recently because of a phone call soliciting my business, so I hope I'm not duplicating anything. The question I have what do you think, or is there any information to the effect that Putin might be wanting to use the oil wealth of Russia to bring the United States down a peg because of its weakness in the oil?
Right. That's a good question. After 9/11, there was a brief attempt to try to create what they called an energy dialogue between the United States and Russia, between, in effect, the world's largest energy consumer, that's us, and one of the world's largest energy producers, and of course that's Russia. It didn't go anywhere, partly because of politics, partly because of the fact that, frankly, it's hard to ship oil that's pumped out of Siberia all the way across an ocean to the United States. So right now, Russia is looking a little bit more toward China. China ultimately is going to be a very big customer of Russia because it's increasing its demand and need for oil quantitatively every year. So does that directly affect the United States? No, except in the sense that Russia probably will not be a major supplier for the United States in a direct sense.
And so that playing power politics with oil essentially is just not part of the game.
Well, they play politics with oil, but it's not so much directed at us. It's directed, for instance, at its neighboring countries, the former Soviet republics that it likes to keep in line. They do this with oil and gas in particular. Natural gas is a big Russian product, and from time to time, Moscow will cut off the gas to some former Soviet republic that has behaved badly in its view. But that's a little more distant from us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
All right. Other questions are certainly welcome. We have maybe about 5 minutes left in this part of the show. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We talked a moment ago about the fact that once the Cold War was over, that people in Washington were spending a lot of time talking about what should the relationship be between Russia and the United States, and in what sense Russia still mattered. And I don't think that there was anybody who was saying that it didn't matter at all, but that things definitely were different. So now, though, if we ask that question to us here in the United States, in what sense does Russia matter? How do you answer that?
Well, I mean, there's no question. Russia, after all, is the only country in the world besides the United States that can still blow up the entire world at the push of a button. It is not only a nuclear power at a time when that matters both in terms of the Russian government's policy but also their ability to secure their nuclear stockpiles, for example, against terrorists who have expressed interest in obtaining weapons of mass destruction from the former Soviet Union. Stability in Russia matters because of its geographic position. This is a country that's just too big and centrally located to ignore. Russia is, for better or worse, the major player in Eurasia. It borders on all of the countries that, you know, President Bush had so memorably called the axis of evil. And I think that, you know, in many ways, Putin has tapped into a very important feeling in Russian psyche when he talks about restoring Russia to its rightful place as a great power in the world. And, you know, I think it's good betting that Russia is always going to be a major player in the world because of its strategic location and incredible mineral and oil wealth.
So the next presidential election in Russia would be 2008, is that right?
That's right, and Putin has sworn he's not going to run then because there's a term limit in the Russian Constitution for two terms. He's now in a second term. But this is the real question. You know, nobody really totally believes him. He spent all his time accumulating power back in the Kremlin. So the idea that he would simply walk away from it in 2008 seems implausible to many people. So right now there's a parlor game in Moscow going on trying to invent various ways that he will figure out to keep hold of power. He'll change the constitution, perhaps allow a third term. Maybe he'll rewrite it so that the prime minister is the real power and he'll become prime minister. There's as many ideas for how to do it as there are brains thinking about it right now. He says he won't change the constitution, but that's going to be a real test, and that's certainly what the United States government is viewing as a real test of his commitment to any semblance of democracy.
Is there anyone who seems to be, and perhaps this would have to be someone already within his circle, who would seem to be a leading contender to succeed him if he was not, if he actually abided by the term limits, or whenever the day came when he decided that he wanted to retire from active involvement in politics? Or maybe that day won't come for a long time, that he would be retiring from active involvement in politics.
That's exactly right. I mean, they've already shown their great success in a project like Project Putin, that is inventing somebody tailor-made for the times in Russia. So it's not necessarily a question of who, but when and what are we looking at. But right now there are several people mentioned, you know, for example, Sergei Ivanov, who I talked about, the defense minister, a very close advisor to Putin, also a former KGB spy. He would be extremely controversial, of course, in the West, who views him as the major hardliner, if you will, inside the Kremlin today. There are also some outside pretenders to the throne, but there's no one who really has a stature, and that, I think, is part of why you see so much speculation about Putin himself, and will he remain in power.
Well, I think at that we'll have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. For people who would like to read more about Russia and Russian politics, I suggest you look for the book we've talked about here. It's titled Kremlin Rising, Vladimir Putin's Russia and the End of Revolution, published by Scribner, by our guests, Susan Glasser, Peter Baker. They work for The Washington Post, and they were, between January 2001 and November 2004, they were the Moscow bureau chiefs for the newspaper. And to you, I want to say thanks, Ms. Glasser. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Baker, thank you.
Well, we appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, that's it for us here on Focus. We want to, however, mention before we go that support of the show, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute with offices in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. Also, support comes from Warden Martin Subaru, a Subaru Stellar Performer certified dealership, now in their new location in front of the Savoy 16 Theater across from Warden Martin Nissan. Information on the web at wardenmartin.subaru.com. And that's it for us here on Focus 580. Tomorrow morning on the show, we'll be talking with a Midwestern writer who's written a new humorous novel that's set in Michigan. It's titled The Lake, the River, and the Other Lake. The author, the guest, Steve Amick, he'll be with us tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour. Then we'll be taking questions on vision and eye care. Our guest will be Dr. Jim Farron. He's an optometrist at Carl Clinic in Urbana. That's what we're up to tomorrow, so we hope you can join us. Right now, we want you to stay tuned, because up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine and the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about fame and its aftermath. Our guest will be journalist Douglas Perry, co-author of The 16th Minute, Life in the Aftermath of Fame. Let's turn our attention now to the Chicago Board of Trade. September wheat trading at 340 and a quarter, down 12. September corn, 251, down 9. December, 261, down 9. March, 265 and three quarters, down 7 and three quarters. March corn, 265 and three quarters, down 7 and three quarters. August soybeans, 686, down 31 and a quarter. September, 689, down 31 and three quarters. November, 694 and a half, down 33 and a quarter.